Catherine, so here we meet again for a podcast about culture and food for the soul appropriate subjects. And I was thinking that maybe today we could talk about museums. I don't know about you, but I am having a cabin fever like the rest of the world for being locked up for so long in one place. But I also have something else. I have a museum fever, meaning I'm craving a visit to a museum, which obviously I cannot have at this point. So I thought that maybe we can talk about our respective museum experiences.
Let's remember the incredible museum experiences we had. And maybe that can feed our soul while we're waiting to get out to the next museum, okay?
Right. So why don't we dive in? Maybe you can come up with a museum or a place that you want to talk about, and then we toggle, and then I talk about one of mine, and we just keep changing and chat.
So the first museum I wanted to talk about was the Philadelphia Art Museum. Now, I grew up in Philadelphia, and so I'd been to the art museum many, many times. But in 1996, a group that I was a part of had a private dinner at the museum after the museum was closed. So it was closed to the public. They had a private dinner in the grand sort of hall. And then you could go see the Cézanne exhibit, which was traveling. It was a huge collection of Cézannes. And you were free to go see it. Normally, if you went during the day, it would just be packed. So I was wandering around this exhibit, and I didn't, you know, I thought it would be a pleasurable evening, but I didn't have any expectations. I'd never really focused on Cézanne as an artist. But because it was such a small group relative to the exhibit, you know, you were really able to stand in front of the paintings. And I was standing in front of a Cézanne painting. I don't even remember which one it was. And it was so full of intelligence. It was as though he had put his intelligence into the painting, and it was alive with his intelligence. And even though Cézanne had passed from this world, there was his intelligence just shimmering like it was alive. And I went, oh my God. Oh, you know, it was an incredibly transformative moment for me to realize that an artist could do that. He could literally put his intelligence in a painting and transfer it to you. It would transfer from the painting to you, you know, for the rest of eternity.
Right.
So his intelligence would live for eternity. It was quite remarkable.
I think you touched upon something that I have been thinking about for a long time when going to museums and now looking at those virtual tours of museums. I probably won't even write about it. Because as interesting those virtual tours of museums are, you know, every museum in the world is now putting them up for the coronavirus lockups. The one problem that I have with it is that having done both so-called virtual tours or looked at the paintings, you know, on a computer, online, whatever, in a photo, in a book, and looking at the same paintings in person, it is a completely different experience.
Right, absolutely. Completely different. It's much harder to feel that intelligence if you're online.
Also, you know, I think your experience was unique because you were able to look at the painting undisturbed for as long as you needed to kind of be engrossed in the image that you're looking at. Normally, a museum experience is something completely different because you're being pushed by the next person. Well, right. Not physically, but, you know, kind of compelled to move again, you know, further down because there's a line of people behind you who also want to take a photo of the painting that they're looking at. Sometimes a selfie, which I have never understood the concept of a selfie in front of a painting. It's like, what are you photographing yourself as a proof that you actually visited the Van Gogh sunflowers? What is this for? You might as well take a selfie in front of the museum so you can show it to friends that you have physically been there, done that. You know, it's like a treasure hunt. But regardless, I mean, I'm guilty of taking photos, but I take photos because it's my kind of little diary. So then I would remember which paintings I'm going to write about. So it's my ad memoir. But I, you know, you never get, especially with famous paintings and a big exhibition, you don't get this experience because you cannot stand for the 10, 15 minutes or whatever you need to kind of really get into this painting undisturbed. Because that's not how the contemporary museum experiences are. But it obviously was something transformatory for you if it has been so long ago and you still remembered it so vividly, right?
I remember it as if it was yesterday.
Huh. And that's...
It was so, you know, it was so Cézanne's intelligence and my intelligence just absolutely connected at this extraordinary intimate level, and I understood what he was trying to say. And it was all so clear. It was like I was talking with him.
Wow. I love that experience. I love that story.
Yeah.
Well, so you were in Philadelphia. I'm going to now swing to Moscow, because I think we need to kind of roam the globe in our podcast about museums. You know, even if we are locked in place, we can mentally swing from one part of the globe to the other. And I wanted to tell a couple of interesting stories from two Moscow museums. Moscow is a treasure trove if you're into art, because the amount of stuff that is amassed in museums in Moscow or in Russia in general is just mind-boggling. You could just spend a year going over and over and over from one place to the other and never have enough. It's just a very unappreciated treasure trove because obviously not that many people travel there.
Isn't that amazing? Because I think of St. Petersburg that way. I didn't realize Moscow was that way.
Oh, yes, it is. So let me talk about two different ones. One is called a Diamond Fund, and this is a treasury that is underneath the Red Square near Kremlin, which is not really a museum per se, because everything that is inside is actually not part of the Kremlin Museum. There is a Kremlin Museum where you can visit parts of Kremlin. But the part underneath the Red Square, it's a depository of the biggest diamonds, gold nuggets, jewelry. This is basically a treasury of Russia, which is also kind of open to visitors with a lot of restrictions, because when you go in there, you have to leave everything, your cell phone, your purse, your camera, everything has to be left. You know, there are guys standing with machine pistols ready to shoot. You know, it's a very restricted kind of experience. It's basically you're visiting Fort Knox. But it is definitely worth a visit, because not only you see those mind-boggling jewels, but a lot of them are very kind of interesting, intellectually or artistically very interesting. And I wanted to talk about one of them. There is several major diamonds there. By major, I'm talking about a diamond that is called the Shah diamond. It is about 90 carats. So it's a big chunk of a diamond. It's not a small stone. It's a huge stone. Very right. Beautiful. And it actually has a story. It is one of the seven biggest diamonds in the world or something like this. But the story that it has is that this was a diamond that was found in, I think, 16th or 17th century, was first in India. Then it was, there was a war and Persia took that diamond to Persia. They kind of traveled back and forth between India and Persia in various conflicts, but it ended up in Persia in the 19th century. What happened was that there was a Russian novelist and diplomat and traveler called Alexander Gribojedov, who was sent as an ambassador of Russia to Persia. But unfortunately, there was a conflict at the time, and there was a the whole story was that there was a eunuch who escaped from harem with two women. They asked for an asylum in the Russian embassy. in Tehran, in Persia, the angry crowd stormed the embassy, and they have killed everybody inside that embassy, including Alexander Griboyedov. The Russian Tsar was not amused about that, and the Shah was kind of afraid that that might lead to a Russian invasion of Persia, which Persia wanted to avoid. So they decided to send an apology, you know, an apology in a form of the Shah's nephew carrying that diamond, the Shah diamond. That was in 1829. So they sent that to St. Petersburg as an apology, and the Tsar, who was Nicholas I, who was extremely pissed off at the time and almost went into war, have decided that, well, the diamond is quite nice. So he decided, okay, I'm just going to forgive the killing of my diplomat and keep the diamond. The diamond was more valuable than the diplomat. So that's the story of the diamond, you know. This was kind of basically a bribe, a 90-carat bribe. It's a beautiful diamond. I found it very amusing, the kind of a decision that was made. I mean, obviously, historically, it's a little bit more complicated, you know, that the Tsar was probably not interested in going to conflict with a major empire across the border, and the Griboyedov was kind of pushing for a lot of liberalization that the Tsar was not interested in. But still, the story has stuck, you know. I looked at this diamond and I got a big laugh looking at it.
And it's the names. I've never seen a diamond where the names of the rulers are carved on it. So that's very unique in my experience.
Yeah, the diamond actually has inscriptions. It has carvings. It has two carvings, I think. One, the original one with the year when it was found, and then another one when it was there was a different reign. There's several of those. You know, there's this diamond. There's another one that belonged to Catherine the Great. They're just, you know, beautiful jewels. There's also inside the same museum space, there are those gold nuggets that are, you know, the size of a laptop computer. I have never seen something like this either. You know, they're just amazing. It's a fun place, and it's not easy to visit because, you know, you have to have a special tickets and permission, and, you know, it's not easy to get in. There's a limit of people. Foreigners are kind of limited. It's very complicated, but it's worth it. It's fun. So that is my kind of Moscow story. And I have another one from another Moscow museum, but I can tell you that to you now, or we can go to a different location with you, whichever one you prefer.
So I'll go to Copenhagen, which is not that far away in the scheme of things, especially if you're in Los Angeles. And I had one of the strangest experiences of my life at the Danish National Museum in Copenhagen. I was with Thomas Meyer and one of his colleagues. And we decided we'd go to the museum. And Thomas had been there before, so there was a whole series of things that he wanted to show me. And the reason it was so strange, it was this, I think it was the spring of 2019, we were followed. And we had a number of these experiences in Copenhagen. I will never go back to Copenhagen ever again. But Thomas had never been followed before. And he was very, he thought it was hysterical. And the woman who had clearly was assigned to follow us really had difficulty because Thomas couldn't remember where the exhibits he wanted to show us were. So we kept sort of doubling back and it kept throwing her off. And it made it very obvious she was following us. And I was feeling very irritated because I just wanted to come and relax and, you know, and we weren't there for any political reason. We were there to, you know, to really enjoy the art. Anyway, so I was getting more and more irritated, although Thomas was very funny. He thought it was hysterical. So, and of course, because we kept doubling back, we kept throwing her off, and it almost got to the point where I almost went up to her and said, look, would you like to join our group? Because it would make it much easier for you and easier for us. Anyway, so there was at the top floor an Impressionist collection, a French Impressionist, which I hadn't expected, you know, in the Copenhagen Museum. And I was feeling very, you know, I was having a bit of a pity party about how this had ruined the Danish National Museum for me. And this happens to me sometimes at museums. And I suddenly turned a little corner and there was sort of an enclave. It was a corner in the exhibit and it was very out of the way. It was sort of at the you know, as you're just coming out of the room, and it was just tucked away. And suddenly, there it was. I was looking at one of my favorite Degas pictures ever. I had no idea it was there. It was the last thing I expected to see. It's one of those beautiful paintings that you never think you're going to see again. It's absolutely tiny, but it just speaks to you. And suddenly, you're looking at something which is so explosively and magnificently beautiful and vital and uplifting. And I just had to start to laugh because I thought, why are you getting upset about unimportant things? Look at this.
Hmm.
And you just, it's like the sun breaks through and just, you know, that kind of beauty can lift me. Wow. It can just take my mind flying, soaring. It was so beautiful. I just stood there laughing and laughing and laughing. And the woman following us was just looking at me like, what's going on? What do I write in my report?
This woman is unhinged, right? Who am I following? Well, it's good that you can actually laugh at it, because I get easily thrown off course, you know, not really by anything like that dramatic, but, you know, even if someone is just making stupid comments, you know, I started wearing like headphones and listening to music when I'm looking at museums, because I'm thinking, I'm processing something, and then someone is making those silly comments sometimes. So I remember I was once at D'Orsay, I think. And there was this, you know, classic American couple from Midwest. And there's this woman who is obviously knows something about art, because she was pulling on her hapless husband's sleeve. And she's saying, honey, come here. Look, that chair is here. You know, standing in front of the bungalow. That chair.
So I just have to tell you about this. I just have to tell you about this painting. Degas made a lot of them. They're all over the place. They're called The Races or Before the Races. You know, it's not on a track. It's when you have like a steeplechase race and the horses are out in the field, and it's just a nightmare to get them up into a line and get them to the point where they're even and you can get them started. And they just spin around and fight with each other, and it gets all, you know, because they're all worked up waiting for the, you know, ready to explode into the race. And there's a vitality when you're riding a horse like that. There's an explosive vitality, and it's such a beautiful thing to be out in the field. Though you're trying to get the horses lined up, and there's this explosive vitality, and the jockeys are trying to get the horses. And for some reason, Degas was fascinated with the scene, and so he's done these paintings, The Races, Before the Races, At the Starting Line. They're different names like that. But he captures it. He captures that extraordinary feeling of energy, you know, when you're at the starting line in one of those races. And they're just, you know, for me, they're magical. And they're one of the reasons they're magical is because I used to, you know, I used to jockey some of those horses. Anyway, it's a who would have thought I would find it? You know, I would have expected to find it in Paris or at the Met. I would never have expected to find it at the Danish National Museum, but there it was. So you're next.
Well, I love your experience. I have a suspicion maybe this was part of, you know, Gauguin's legacy, because, you know, maybe he collected, you know, maybe he had a Degas painting because his Danish wife inherited a lot of Gauguin paintings, which are at Glyptotek in Copenhagen. So maybe this is part of Gauguin's collection. Who knows? But I have to look up that painting. Now that you, I mean, I know what you're saying because I've seen several of them, but I didn't know which one is where. So that's fun. Well, I think I still want to have stay in Moscow to tell you another funny story. Well, funny as, I don't know if it's funny. In one hand, it's encouraging. On the other hand, it's kind of depressing. But let me just tell you. So there's a different museum, one of the most adorable, wonderful museums that I could just live in. It's called the Pushkin Museum, which is the art museum in Moscow, very famous. Which has different collections of various international art. And I'm going to start from a different angle. There was someone called Heinrich Schliemann, who was a trader, adventurer, traveler in the 19th century. And one of the fathers of archaeology, even though at the time archaeology was not exactly what it is now, and he did a lot of, he was a little bit of an amateurish archaeologist, but he's extremely famous in arts and archaeology history because against any popular theories, he decided upon reading up and finding out about Troy that he's going to find Troy. And not only did he did think that he would like to find it, he did find it by going to a hill called Hisarlik in Anatolia in southern Turkey and excavating there roughly between like 1870 and 1890. For about 20 years, he was excavating there. He did trample upon a lot of archaeological evidence, if you like, but in all fairness, you know, archaeology was not a very formal science. You know, he has kind of laid grounds to a lot of archaeological processes. What he has discovered is what he named a Priam's treasure or the discovery of Homer's Troy. In reality, that site has several layers of different inhabitation over hundreds of years. So there's not one Troy, there's several Troys, one upon the other. But he did find a treasure, which consists of, you know, a lot of pottery and a lot of ornaments, a lot of them gold ornaments, which kind of fired up the imagination of a lot of amateur archaeologists. And this...
What year was it dated to?
Well, technically, well, you know, that's the problem because there's several Troys, but we're talking, you know, about 3,000 right. years old, but about, because it depends from which layer and his excavation were kind of like a mix-up of several things. But yes, this is right. technically the treasure of Troy that is described by Homer. His archaeological findings have been stored in the museum in Berlin from about 1890s or 1900s until the Second World War. Then they disappeared. So here I am walking around the Pushkin Museum many, many, many years later, you know, like, let's say, the 2010, more or less, 2011, something like this. And in one of the wings of the Pushkin Museums, what do I see? I see the Priam's treasure, you know, the gold necklaces, the head, you know, the famous yeah. headdress that Sophia, the wife of Heinrich Schliemann, was wearing in a famous photo that, you know, they got so much flack about. All of this has resurfaced at the Pushkin Museum in 1994, apparently, you know, after having disappeared in the Second World War, you know.
Now, why did the Germans never make them give it back?
Well, the Germans, I read up about it later. I mean, for me, it was just a shock because I never kind of traced it back in media, in newspapers, so I didn't know about it. And here I am just walking around the museum, completely convinced that, you know, that Priam's treasure has disappeared in the depths of the Second World War. And here is the whole wing, and I'm looking at it from up close, which was a wonderful experience, by the way. But what happened is that, you know, when this has surfaced in 1994 at the Pushkin Museum, you know, there was a delegation of German historians, archaeologists who went there to examine it. The consensus is that this is most likely authentic, you know, this is not a copy or whatever. This was... in Berlin, they packed it, you know, at the beginning of the Second World War, and then the crates have disappeared. You know, some of it resurfaced in some other places after the war, but the main part of the treasure is the one that's resurfaced in Moscow. Moscow, I mean, Russia has passed in 1998, so about 4 years later, they passed a law probably aimed at that find, that if something has been found or is currently at the territory of the Russian Federation, that it is not being returned to anybody, just to prevent the stuff going back. Russian museums are unfortunately or fortunately full of things that have little plaques underneath saying acquired in 1945. so, you know, there is not much, you know, even diplomacy tied to that. So that's what I was saying. This is, on one hand, it is a encouraging story because that means that at least that treasure has not been completely destroyed during the war, the Second World War, and it has survived somehow. On the other hand, it's a little bit sad because, of course, it survived, but in probably not in exactly the right country that it should have been surviving.
Well, here's the thing: if the Germans were to insist that Russia give it back,
well, they did ask for
Turkey
it.
Turkey could insist that Germany give it back, right?
Well, except that Troy, at the time that Troy was not, and that was actually not Turkey. You know, Turkey is a country; it's a very kind of recent invention. You know, the Greeks might come there and say, well, excuse us, but this is Homer and Troy and history of Greece. So frankly speaking, the owners should be Greeks, right. Certainly not the Turks, and certainly not the Russians. Schliemann was German, and he found the stuff and brought it to Germany, and it was displayed at the German Berlin Museum for decades. So I would probably opt for Germany, but whatever. So all I'm saying is this is kind of like a bittersweet. On one hand, I'm happy it hasn't been destroyed. On the other hand, it's a little bit sad because it touches upon, you know, the ownership and the returns and keeping and who it belongs to, you know, the never-ending story, the history of art. But these are my two kind of observations about the treasures of the Russian museums. Your turn.
So let's go to Amsterdam to the Rijksmuseum, which I just think the Rijksmuseum is one of the finest museums in the world. And the first time I went there, I knew I was going to see the Night Watch, which is the incredible, very large, almost mural-like artwork of the, you know, sort of the Amsterdam militia, and painted by Rembrandt. And it's considered, you know, the great treasure of the Netherlands. Anyway, I got a BBC. There's a BBC documentary just on the Night Watch. And I did a lot. I think I watched about 3 or 4 documentaries on Rembrandt, but I'd never seen a Rembrandt in person. And when I went, it was just, you just stood before it. And it was, you saw the transition of painting where literally artists could paint, you know, a human has a body, but then we have an energetic body. We have an aura. Mm-hmm. And Rembrandt was one of the painters who just somehow mastered how to paint a human's light and the light that comes from the aura. I don't know how to explain. You just have to go look at it. But the Night Watch not only had that feature, but you could see all these people had paid Rembrandt a certain amount of money. It was very entrepreneurial, but you could see everybody paid to be in the painting. It's kind of a...
Well, you can see a few people who probably didn't pay enough because you only see parts of their faces.
Right, exactly. But my favorite, I wanted to bring up the Rijksmuseum because I went back a couple years later to see when we were celebrating Da Vinci's 500th year, the Rembrandt was also having, I think, 350. And the Rijksmuseum put up all the Rembrandts. So a lot of the etchings that aren't normally all on show came out. And that was fun for me, not because of something that happened between me and the art, was simply watching you. We turned the corner and you saw the Rijksmuseum and you just looked like you were about to dive into a Godiva chocolate store. And then you went to the Rembrandt's exhibit, and it was, you know, it was amazing. It was incredible. But what was funny was when you finally came out, because I tend to do these things much faster than you. When you finally came out, Robert kept talking about, he would ask you a question, and then everybody was listening to your answer. And so I have this image of Nina Hein does the Rijksmuseum.
we did write about it. You know, with we have a foot for the soul about all the Rembrandts.
I know. But it was at the Rijksmuseum I discovered that you have like a Wikipedia in your head of all these artists. It's amazing to me that you can, you know, I can retain financial information, but I can't retain that much information on that many artists. And it was really funny for me to see. But I will never forget. And, you know, Robert captured it on video, your face, when you first saw the Rijksmuseum. It was just like, oh boy, this is going to be great.
I don't know. It's fun. But actually, anyway, to speak to exactly that exhibition, there's something else that struck me, because thanks to you and Robert, I got inspired and went to a local museum in the northern part of Holland where Saskia, Rembrandt's first wife, comes from. There's a small local museum, and because of this 350th anniversary, they had a special exhibition on Rembrandt, Saskia, people living there.
It was in Leeuwarden.
Yes, Leeuwarden. And what struck me there is that the way they had it arranged, that there were various paintings by local Dutch artists of the era, you know, of portraits of various kinds. So I'm walking through there, and then suddenly there is this painting that it just like jumps at you from, you know, 10, 15 others around it from far away. Then, of course, you come up to it and you see that this right. is a portrait of Saskia that the museum has borrowed from some other place, you know, to display to show Saskia in the context. And that is where you see exactly what you're talking about, that his portraits, you know, self-portraits or portraits of other people, and especially the people he loved the most, meaning Saskia and Titus, his son, are such amazing psychological insights into people's soul or character, whatever it is. They are just so much different from...
Amazing.
From just a painting of, you know, the features, you know, like a photograph. These are not photographs. These are insights into right. people's soul. And that was the experience. It's just like literally you see 10 other, and there was even a picture, a portrait of Saskia painted by some other local painter because she was from there. So they had that portrait, and which was nice. Certainly much better than what most people could paint. It was painted very well. But it didn't have that kind of jumping at you. It was a completely different experience. So we both had the same experience, which I'm sure a lot of people have had as well.
Yeah, Rembrandt, you know, he can really paint a person's energy. It's remarkable. Okay, so I'm gonna go to Milan next mm-hmm. and talk about the Last Supper. Because I, and you're probably, I'm every time I talk about the Last Supper and I say what I'm about to say, I get yelled at, but I don't care. So you may yell at me because I don't think we've talked about this. But anyway, so I've seen thousands of posters and pictures of the Last Supper. And I would never say that it was high on my list of favorite paintings. But I love Da Vinci, you know, so I love everything Da Vinci does. Anyway, we went to see The Last Supper. We had a wonderful guide who told us, you know, don't look at The Last Supper. When you come into the room, look at the mural on the opposite wall and then spin and turn and look at The Last Supper. So we did it. And the mural on the wall was very beautiful, but it was very sort of two-dimensional and flat. And then you turn and you look at The Last Supper and you realize, wow. You know, at that time, what a revolution, again, in painting people's aura, their energy. But the other thing, and I never expected this to happen, was I looked at the person sitting to Jesus's left when you're staring at the painting, and I realized, oh my God, I think it's a woman. You know, so you have this huge debate about, you know, is that John the Baptist or is that Mary? And I've never, you know, I'm not interested in that debate. It's just not my thing. I've never cared. I'm not, you know, I'm looking at it as a, I don't know. So, but I looked at it and I said, oh my God, that's a woman. It's a woman.
I totally agree. And, I mean, it looks like a beautiful woman. It doesn't look like a guy.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's just, right. It's not a guy. It's a woman. And I was shocked because it's so clear. And so, you know, I mean, there's no politics in me on any of that. I couldn't, you know, it, to me, it's whatever Da Vinci wanted it to be, but clearly Da Vinci wanted it to be a woman. And the fact that this is not, I just seem completely obvious. Anyway, it was really funny because right after I left Milan, I went up to see Thomas Meyer And he's got a portrait of the Last Supper in his dining room. And I said, you know, I just came from Milan and I said, that's a woman. And he got really angry. And he said, oh, you're not into any of that conspiracy theory. I said, I'm not saying it because of any conspiracy theory. I'm saying because I went to see the painting and it's a woman. And anyway, so that was one thing. But then the second thing was, you know, I tend to think of many things that happen in history because, you know, people are devious or greedy, but something always happens to remind you how completely stupid we can be. And when you look at the Last Supper and you realize part of the painting has been cut so that they could put in a door so the monks at the monastery could get to the kitchen faster. They cut Jesus's feet out from under him. Now, talk about a metaphor.
Yes, I think it's definitely a metaphor.
And I looked at this magnificent painting and realized the stupid monks had cut out part of one of the greatest paintings in the history of the world to make room for a door. Can you believe it? It was so shocking, and I thought, you know, whatever happens to me for the rest of my life, when I make a stupid mistake, I'm going to say to myself, it could be worse. I could be those monks. Anyway, so the Last Supper was absolutely breathtaking. It was magnificent. And I, you know, it took my breath away and it said so many different things. And we were lucky we had a fabulous guide.
Yeah.
So,
yes,
anyway,
yes, that, it was a wonderful experience.
The second thing I wanted to mention in Milan, you know, and I could talk about all of Da Vinci. Every time I see a Da Vinci, it's a spectacular experience. But we were in, I forget what the name of the smaller, the Bibliothèque Museum. And we were going around looking at these etchings. And there was this etching that I absolutely loved. And when I was looking at it, Nina, I felt like it was a little bit like the Cézanne. I was talking with Leonardo. He was there. He was my teacher. There was an intimate connection with his intelligence that was so real. And this little etching is, he's got a list. It's his bucket list. It's all the places he wants to go to. And then there's a map of Europe and Eurasia. And he's got this list of places, and then he's got a map. And then he's got a drawing of a flying machine. And you realize the guy is doodling about how he's going to make it possible for himself to see all the places he wants to see on his bucket list.
Yeah, I love that little map. Yes, I agree. It's a little map of Europe, a contours of Europe, very well drawn, actually. You know, tiny kind of little doodle. And actually, England is cut out by someone much later. You know, someone just cut out the England from that map, you know, probably a couple of centuries later. That drawing is actually a real drawing. It's not an etching or anything. It's his manuscript. It's his own drawing. And they are at the Pinacoteca Ambrosiana in Milano, if someone wants to visit.
I don't know. When I took a look at that, I could, you know, because we were outside of, what is it, the wonderful opera house.
La Scala.
You know, you have that, La Scala, you have that statue of Leonardo with his students beneath him. And the journalist that you interviewed about it talked about the wine in the bottles. The teacher flows the wine into the bottles of the students. And you just felt like that, you know, that gift, that intelligence, that learning was flowing out of this into you from Leonardo.
Mm-hmm. We have that interview. That's interview with Paola Jacobi on our Food for the Soul website. If someone wants to see it,
yeah, that was marvelous.
She talks about
that was marvelous, and it was funny because she referred to him again and again as Leonardo. Because you realize everybody in Milan has a relationship with Leonardo. It's alive.
Yeah, he's one of the boys. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so that's it for me in Milan.
Okay. So let's just swing to a completely different continent. I want to talk about China for a second, just because, you know, I want something exotic in our stories. And this is not the classic China of Beijing and Tonghuang grottos and Xi'an and all the places that all the tourists go. I want to talk about a province called Hunan, which is in the south, exactly in the middle of China, in the south, southern part, but it's really in the middle of China as the country. Which is a cradle of Chinese archaeological and history and history as a nation. It's certainly one of the most amazing archaeological sites because in 1970s, through the typical story of a farmer who was digging a ditch for his well, you know, that's usually what happens in with many archaeological discoveries. They have discovered a tomb from about 200 years BC. So that would be well over 2,000 years old, of someone who was the prince of the province. There were two tombs. One of them was robbed, so that's the one of the marquis. But his wife's tomb was never found until 1970s when they opened that. It is somehow like a discovery comparable to the Tutankhamun's tomb in Egypt, because not only it was not robbed, but it was also as elaborate as anything that you would find in ancient Egypt. The princess, if you like, it was a mummy that was totally preserved in several coffins, you know, each of them more elaborate than the other, you know, lacquered. And there was a wooden coffin on the very top, and then there was a stone coffin around it. So several layers have protected her body for thousands of years. And they have found a huge trove of everything, you know, household utensils, plates, vases, many items of clothing, including like gauze dresses and silk dresses in perfectly preserved food that was perfectly preserved, all the grains and all the foodstuffs, cosmetic boxes and books, a huge amount of books. They were kind of written on bamboo sticks, not on paper, thank God. So they were preserved quite well. So this is basically a history of the Han dynasty knowledge in archaeology, warfare, literature, poetry, mathematics, astronomy. Everything was there.
Wow.
The trove that has been found is as historically or archaeologically or culturally significant as the Tutankhamun tomb. But of course, because it's in the central China and, you know, 1970s was still during the Cultural Revolution, so China was kind of isolated at the time. And because it is not on the, you know, kind of major track of tourist groups going to, I don't know, Shanghai, Beijing or Xi'an or some places like this. So this is not very well known outside China. I mean, in China, it's quite well known and there are millions of tourists who go there all the time. The stuff is stored in the Hunan Provincial Museum that has a lot of artifacts that go like back 4,000 years old. They are 4,000 years old. It's a wonderful archaeological museum and an archaeological find, but of course, because it's slightly off beaten track, it is not very well known. But I went there several times. And
how do they store the texts?
These texts were actually preserved on a kind of like stripes of bamboo. So they are like, imagine the stripes that you would have on a fan, right? About an inch wide, sometimes a little bit more, depending on how wide was the bamboo. And then, you know, written with an ink on it.
Right.
Thank God, because if they had been written on, let's say, paper, which is a Chinese invention as well, or even reeds, for example, they don't get preserved very well. But on those bamboo sticks inside this hermetically sealed tomb, they have survived.
Right.
You can actually see them. You know, the writing is very clear. And because Chinese characters have had obviously some evolution, but basically they haven't fundamentally changed in the last 4,000 years or 2,000 years for sure. They're quite readable. You know, you don't need to do much deciphering like you do with Egyptian hieroglyphs to be able to read the text if you know classical Chinese and all the evolution of the handwriting. So it is a wonderful archaeological find, you know, talks about the Han dynasty. Han dynasty is kind of, you know, let's say about 500 years before Christ and about 300-400 years afterwards, about. So it's around that period. So that would be like a Roman period in European history.
It looks like a museum where you could spend several days.
Oh, it's wonderful. And the way they have done the display of it, you know, you go on the kind of on a gallery and the tomb is down from the gallery. So you can just look all the layers from either up top, or you can see it from the side, and then everything that they took out from this tomb. And this is a huge collection of lacquered boxes and pottery and books, and the clothing are amazing. You know, the gauze dresses made of, you know, like a gauze, you know how thin that is. And it's still completely preserved. It's just amazing. So that was one of the biggest treats. I have not been to the Egyptian Tutankhamun tomb, unfortunately. I have not had a opportunity. So for me, that was like the opportunity to see something incredibly old and incredibly archaeologically and culturally valuable that not that many people have seen. Highly recommend if anybody ever travels in China.
if we can ever get in. Okay, so let me take you to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. Edinburgh, I love Edinburgh. It's such a magnificent city, but I was there for a week or maybe 5 days, and I went, there are two things I wanted to describe. The first is I went to the National Museum, which is absolutely magnificent. And there's a painting I've always loved called Monarch in the Glen of a beautiful stag standing with the Highlands in behind him. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely breathtaking. It's a huge, huge oil painting. And again, it was one of those things where it never occurred to me that I would ever see it in person. I've seen it in posters or, you know, pictures. And I didn't realize it was in the Scottish National Museum. And I was walking through an exhibit and suddenly something stopped me. It was just a feeling that came over and it said, look to your left. And it was open. It was like on a balcony. So there was nothing hanging on the left. There was no wall there. You just looked across the whole gallery. And I turned left and there it was. It was hanging down from the ceiling on this huge wall, like on, you know, it was a wall that went up several stories and it was the top so that you could clearly see it from both below and from the floor I was on. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever, when you were a kid, been on a seesaw and then somebody got off and you dropped to the ground and it knocked the air out of you. Mm-hmm. But it just completely knocked the air out of me. Luckily, there was a place to sit. I just sat down and looked at it for a long, long time. Now, I don't have a theory on why I love it so much, but it just feels like freedom. It you know, you have this magnificent stag and he's, you know, in the Highlands and he's the king of the Highlands. And it just, you know, it just says, this is what it is to be free.
Well, he's definitely a symbolic painting, actually, which has been, I think, purchased at some point by Scotland. It wasn't originally there.
Where was it?
I would have to look it up, but I vaguely remember, I know the painting, and I vaguely remember that I think this painting has been purchased at some point with like a collection of money in Scotland to purchase that painting. It was somewhere else originally. But there's two things. Well, first of all, you know, Scotland has a huge history of fight for independence, which I don't think is even completely concluded. So I can see how this is an amazingly symbolic painting for Scotland. But I think there's also something else that you love in that museum, because when I was going there, I remember you telling me to go and check it out.
So that's the castle. So there were many other things in the National Museum, but now I'm going to tell you about Edinburgh Castle. I had a very extraordinary month in 2012 when suddenly my relationship with three people critical to my business, who were not connected to each other, suddenly went from being fantastic to horrible. And it was one of the most frightening experiences of my life. It was almost though they'd been taken over with zombies or something. I have no idea, but I found myself in an unbelievably stressful situation. And that's when I decided, you know something? I'm going to take this company down to the people who have integrity. And from now on, I'm just going to ask the question, what can we do with the people who have integrity? That's it. I've had it. And, you know, there was something about sort of how the corruption was sort of separating people and the middle of the road was going away. Anyway, so I've been through this very stressful period, and it started in 2012 that I would get irregular heartbeats, and it was very draining. And I've been living with this for a couple of years, because one of the things I've learned, if this happens to you, don't go to the American medical system, because they'll just make it worse. So I was on my own on this one. So anyway, I was in the hotel and I was working on a presentation for a conference that I was going to give when I got back to the United States. And I finished early and I thought, oh, great, I have time to run up to the castle. The castle was right above where my hotel was. And I ran up and I hadn't had lunch yet. I hadn't eaten yet that day. So I got my ticket and I got my tour guide. And I went into a little restaurant by the entrance to the castle to have lunch because I was hungry and I was reading the tour guide. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, the Stone of Destiny is here. Now, the Stone of Destiny is a stone. It's a large, sort of very simple block. And it has traditionally always sat under the chair that the kings of Scotland were coronated under. And it's said to be a step in Jacob's ladder. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, at the center is the foundation stone, mm-hmm. or foundation rock, which is also said to be part of Jacob's ladder, whatever that means. I have never researched it, so I have no idea what it means. Anyway, I had been in Washington when there was a big fight, and the British, of course, had gotten the Stone of Destiny away from the Scots, and the Scots were eager to have it. Some kids got together, stole it to take it back to Scotland. There was a basic brouhaha. One thing led to another, and the British decided to give it back to Scotland on the assumption, with the agreement, that any time a King of England was coronated, they could borrow the stone for the coronation. And so the stone was returned in 1996 to Scotland. And I read it in the Wall Street Journal. I almost fell off my chair, Nina, because if you look at the history of this stone and sort of how the secret societies feel about it, you know, I would have told you the British would never have given it back. So I said, Teutonic plates moving, something big is up. So
Catherine, they gave up Hong Kong.
Right. Right. That's another story. We'll talk about that later. Anyway, but, you know, my upbringing had persuaded me that this stone was very, very, very important. Mm-hmm. So I finish lunch and I make an immediate beeline to the stone. And it was very strangely presented. It's behind sort of like a glass box. Mm-hmm. And they have all these gold crowns and jewels sitting on top of it. It's like, and my immediate thought was, what are the tchotchkes doing on top of the stone? Somebody thought this was a good idea. Anyway, I walk up to the stone, stand in front of it, and bam, my heart goes right. Huh. Just bam.
Really?
Spontaneous healing, completely over, no problem ever since.
Now that is amazing. The healing power of...
completely amazing.
I don't know what.
You went... When I was standing in front of it, I felt complete perfection coherence. You know, I felt as though the world was 100% completely coherent and I was at home. Perfect peace. It's extraordinary.
It is an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. And anyway, needless to say, I thoroughly enjoyed Edinburgh Castle.
I'd say, well, I love the two, and I love seeing the stone, but I have not had that kind of extraordinary experience, which I love the story. you know what? We are also running out of time. There's probably many more museum stories that we could tell. I still have a few of them up my sleeve, but we are running out of time. So maybe this is something that we're going to defer for the next podcast. But I love your healing story to conclude our...
There's just one thing I do want to say. Mm-hmm. I am the kind of person, you are always eager to go to a museum. I'm the kind of person who says, you know I should do this. I know it's important, blah, 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 but I have work to do. I'm always a little bit, you know, you have to pull me out of my chair to get me to go. And then these absolutely magical things happen. Always. I mean, not every time, but I have never left a museum when I didn't say, why was I reluctant to get off my butt and go? I absolutely love that. So don't be afraid to, you know, to discipline yourself to go, because it's amazing what happens when you do.
Well, plus, you know, it's not a visit to a dentist, you know. Going to a museum is usually not that hard. Yes, you have to get off your butt and go there.
But for me, there is a lot of modern art that, you remember the sewer?
Oh, yeah. the Fondazione Prada. Yes, but, you know, there is a, actually, you know, with modern art, I probably have to write about it, or we have to go to more museums, and I have to kind of show you that some of the modern art is amazingly wonderful. It's just that
that's
hard
true.
To find.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
And I have, and I have a problem writing about it because unfortunately a lot of it I cannot illustrate. And if I cannot illustrate because we don't have the rights to modern art images, then obviously I cannot write the story. But if I could, I would write all the time about modern art. There is wonderful modern art, but it's much harder to find. It becomes a challenge and like a treasure hunt because you have to wade through so many things that are so hideous that it's not easy to find. Catherine, I think we have again wasted a perfectly good hour of listeners' time musing about things we love, and in my case, things that I cannot get to, and I'm literally climbing walls because for me, that's the only place I'm ever happy is a museum, and I haven't been in one in months. And have no idea when I will ever have a chance, but maybe that will inspire somebody to, you know, go visit, explore, but definitely in person whenever they can and not virtually, because I'm a little bit tired of the virtual visits. and thank you for all those inspiring, heartfelt, emotional stories that museum you would think would be the last place that you would have the kind of healing experiences, but you clearly have. So I love the story. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the one thing I was not expecting was a heart operation in front of the Stone of Destiny.
You're the least New Age person I know. So this is really an amazing story. Thank you very much. And till the next one.
Thank you. Okay. You have a wonderful day, Nina Hein. We love Food for the Soul.
Thank you very much.
Bye.